Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. Today, we will feature a number of wildlife stories on the program, starting with controversy surrounding a bison holding area in Yellowstone and the Women's Antelope Hunt.
I know a lot of people still have the mindset that hunting is a man's sport.
A story about how Wyoming's leaders are looking to change the Endangered Species Act.
For every 100 species added to the list, only 3 have recovered enough to come off of the list.
And we'll explore the challenge of studying moose.
As soon as she has our scent and hears a twig snap, then the game's up and they usually walk off.
Join us for an hour of wildlife stories on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to the Wildlife Edition of Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. In the next hour, we'll bring you several stories about wildlife that we've explored on this program. We will begin, though, with a brand new story. Since the beginning of this year, there's been 4 criminal acts at the Stevens Creek facility in Yellowstone National Park. This facility is the central hub for the management of the Yellowstone Park bison herd. Bison, or buffalo, once roamed the American plains in the millions. But today, about 4,200 exist. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kedelska has more.
2 of the recent incidents involved members of the Wild Buffalo Defense Group blocking access to the Stevens Creek facility. That's the site where bison are captured and shipped live to tribes or to facilities to be slaughtered. Jack Tripper is a member of the group, and he says they're hoping this will raise awareness to end the current management of the Yellowstone Park bison herd and allow the animals to roam free.
Ultimately, I think what we're saying is that actual management of the buffalo would shift more to some sort of tribal council rather than the conglomeration of national park and state entities.
The controversy here is how bison have been managed. One program holds the animals for at least 2 years in order to ensure that they are free of brucellosis before the animals are shipped to tribal or public land. Brucellosis is a disease that can cause livestock to miscarry. Groups argue that holding them domesticates the wild animal. And recently, over 100 bison were illegally freed from a quarantine pen to stop this practice. Dan Wink, the superintendent of Yellowstone National Park, says the quarantine program allows fewer animals to be slaughtered in the long run. He says releasing the bison was a bad idea.
Mm-hmm. I think it was short-sighted. I mean, if their goal is to get bison, if everyone's goal is to get bison on a wider landscape in the West.
Currently, the Yellowstone herd is managed by the Interagency Bison Management Plan, or IBMP, which includes state, federal, and tribal agencies. Their 2 main goals are to maintain a wild, free-ranging bison population of around 3,000 and to reduce the risk of brucellosis transmission from bison to cattle. But Wink says this isn't as easy as it seems.
Managing any wildlife in modern society is different than it was in the 1800s. There's a lot of competition. I think there's competition for grass between wildlife and stock growers. That, I think, plays into it.
The IBMP was also a compromise to Montana's lawsuit over bison migrating out of the park with the chance of transmitting brucellosis to their cattle. Mike Honeycott of the Montana Livestock Department admits there hasn't been a documented case of brucellosis transmission from bison to cattle, but he says the U.S. and international fear of brucellosis can harm the ability of Montana producers to sell their product.
And with that comes potential for restrictions and some might even say sanctions that have great economic benefit to the state of Montana.
Honeycott and Wank think the quarantine program and tribal and treaty hunts outside of the park should be able to manage the population and reduce lethal culling of the herd. Tom McDonald is the division manager of wildlife for the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes located in Montana. He agrees that hunting should be a primary long-term tool, but there's a limiting factor.
If you didn't have a park boundary, you just had this polygon, and hunting was available over the entire landscape that bison tread upon, no, there wouldn't be an administrative slaughter at all or a harvest. It would be completely done by hunting, no doubt.
Wank says hunting in the park will never be an option.
You know, we would certainly fight that. I mean, hunting within the boundaries of Yellowstone National Park would certainly, that would be probably an issue that would have worldwide attention.
No matter the details of terms, the IBMP agencies agree they want to reduce the number of bison slaughtered. While some think this is a step forward, Jack Tripper of the Wild Buffalo Defense Group wants to stop the capture program and won't stop until buffalo are allowed to expand naturally in the landscape. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska from the Center of the West in Cody.
Women still only make up a small percentage of all hunters, but that number has increased significantly in recent years. Now, organizations like the Wyoming Women's Foundation want to encourage more growth through mentorship. The group says hunting is an important way to teach self-sufficiency and economic independence. A few years back, Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov tagged along on the state's inaugural Women's Antelope Hunt and filed this report, which won a national award for the best use of sound.
The time of departure for each team of hunters was set for 5:30 a.m., but a snowstorm hit overnight, and at 6, the electricity was still out, snow and wind howled outside, and antsy women in camouflage ate their eggs by candlelight. This was unusual October weather, even for Wyoming. Marilyn Kite was one of the first people who came up with the idea of the Women's Antelope Hunt. She was Wyoming's first woman to serve as Supreme Court Justice.
Unfortunately, there are not very many women that actively hunt.
In Wyoming, about 16% of hunters are women. Nationwide, that number is closer to 11%. But from 2006 to 2011, the number of women hunting in the U.S. increased by a quarter. And that's a trend Kite wants to encourage.
We've found it to be just great recreation, lots of fun, and the camaraderie of it is why you do it, really. But we also really like the meat.
The meat is kind of the clincher here. The event is sponsored by the Wyoming Women's Foundation, whose mission is to help women reach self-sufficiency.
There's a lot of young women who are single mothers who are trying to provide for their families, and that's certainly one way to do it.
Crystal Mayfield is a single mom from Laramie who was sponsored to come on the hunt. She's harvested elk before and hopes an all-women's hunt will take some of the intimidation out of the sport for others.
Well, I know a lot of people still have the mindset that hunting is a man's sport.
She was partnered with Terry Heaton of Gillette, who's a Navy veteran. Their guide was Fred Williams. Williams says women often make good hunters because they're more focused and patient than men. But there was very little patience that morning. They finally set off to the private ranch where they plan to hunt around 10 a.m.
About 29 degrees right now.
Just to show how outnumbered women are in hunting, most of the guides on this women's hunt were men, and both Mayfield and Heaton almost exclusively hunt with their dads. Heaton says the female camaraderie is a welcome change.
It's different than going with my dad and brother. A lot more giggling, I think.
As they drive, they take turns sliding down their mud and snow-streaked windows to look for antelope, and Williams quizzes Mayfield on her skill level.
I was doing 200 yards yesterday.
Really?
Yeah.
You're hitting in the bolt by 200 yards?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
Good for you. You're like Danny Oakley.
When they spot some antelope in the distance,
2 bucks to the right. Right,
they park and start stalking them on foot. Williams has Mayfield load a bullet in the chamber, and they proceed quietly through a field strewn with cottonwoods and cows and covered in a lot of wet snow. When they reach a little rise that looks over the grazing antelope, Williams takes Mayfield up to prepare for her shot, and Heaton stays behind to wait and wait.
My legs are falling asleep.
Finally, Mayfield takes aim.
Here goes.
And shoots. She misses that buck. In fact, both women miss their shots that day. The 35-mile-an-hour winds don't make it easy to shoot. On the drive back to the ranch, Mayfield says she's not upset, but adds that missing is easier in the company of women.
When I missed that shot, I didn't feel like a loser when I went and told Tara that, oh, I missed it. Like, I didn't feel like she was going to be like, oh, you're a huge loser. So that was nice, too.
Is that what your dad told you?
My dad wouldn't have, but my brother easily would have been like, oh, I can't believe you missed that. Like, you're stupid.
As is typical in Wyoming weather, the next day is sunny, there's no wind, and it's beautiful. Both Heaton and Mayfield get their antelope in one shot and receive the Annie Oakley Award for it. In fact, 32 of the 34 women on the hunt fill their tags. One first-time hunter who got a buck says she can't wait to teach her son how to hunt. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
When we come back, we'll have stories about ravens and moose. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. When people think of ravens, they often think of Edgar Allan Poe.
What this grim, ungainly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore meant in croaking evermore.
I talked to a sage-grouse ecologist, and it's a different story. In the last 50 years, as energy development has moved in, raven numbers have skyrocketed. Several new studies across the West show that these ominous birds of yore are feasting on sage-grouse eggs and chicks, a species that's already on the brink of extinction. And so to protect them, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is considering upping the number of ravens they're controlling lethally. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports.
Visit any landfill in Wyoming, and you'd think you'd stepped into a Hitchcock film. Hundreds of blackbirds flapping overhead, fighting over scraps, and making strange, almost human-like sounds. It might seem like a weird place to go bird watching, but wildlife ecologist Dr. Charles Preston in Cody says a landfill is a great place to see how ravens take advantage of disturbed landscapes such as this one, a dump in the middle of the otherwise wild sagebrush.
Ravens are one of the few species that we know will communicate with one another about a distant activity. That's called displacement.
Displacement is when ravens gather at night and pass along information about where to find the best food, a fresh roadkill carcass, say, and then show up the next day by the dozens. And he says that's also what makes ravens formidable predators to sage grouse.
It is a challenge because they are so smart. So it's not easy to trick them. It's not easy to put a scarecrow up or something.
There are raven hotspots.
That's Jonathan Dinkins, a researcher with the University of Wyoming, working on a 4-year study of ravens and their effects on sage-grouse nests. He says other studies in Nevada and Idaho agree. Raven populations aren't out of control everywhere, just in isolated zones.
Our raven data suggests that a good portion of Wyoming doesn't have a raven problem. So how do you identify where those areas are?
Dinkins says it's important to know exactly where these so-called hotspots are if you want to control their numbers. He says one way is to find swaths of sagebrush disturbed by human structures, like windmills,
communication towers, oil structures, power lines. Those produce nesting structure for ravens.
And Dinkins says you can't necessarily assume raven hotspots are going to spring up around energy development.
Interestingly, during our study, over half of the study sites that we had that had high raven abundance, they were not in oil fields.
But the kind of sprawl and traffic and roadkill that come as part of the oil field package does mean more ravens. Dinkins' study and others all seem to show that more ravens appears to mean fewer sage grouse are hatching. Armed with this data, Wyoming recently decided to change its rules about killing ravens, which are protected as migratory birds. In the past, ravens could only be killed to protect livestock or human health. But for the first time, it'll be legal to use poison control on ravens to benefit a wildlife species, sage grouse. Wyoming sage grouse coordinator Tom Christensen.
They use a very specific corvicide that targets
only those ravens on those dump sites.
And researcher Dinkins says, ideally, only using corvicide, a raven-killing chemical, in those areas where raven hotspots overlap with the best sage-grouse habitat. But even Christensen concedes that killing ravens is a temporary fix, since they're territorial. An empty roost is like an empty hotel room at Cheyenne Frontier Days. It fills up instantly.
The other thing that's an unknown here is if actually controlling ravens results in a benefit to sage-grouse. We surmise that, but we don't have hard data to say that the control of ravens results in more sage-grouse.
And that's why ecologist Charles Preston says a campaign to kill ravens could be a job with no end in sight. The best way to control ravens, he says, is to bring sagebrush country back into balance. Cluster energy structures in limited areas, close down dumps in sage-grouse habitat, and help raven predators thrive. Who likes to eat ravens? Golden eagles do. And so do weasels, coyotes, owls.
So encouraging some of the predators of ravens is often one of the best ways. That's the natural biological control.
Preston says ravens aren't Poe's evil bird. They're just opportunists. To control them, he says, we need healthier sage lands. Otherwise, the greater sage grouse could be...
never, never more.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Most moose herds in Wyoming are in decline, but the Snowy Range moose herd appears to be an exception. After a moose reintroduction in northern Colorado, they started showing up in the Snowy Range Mountains west of Laramie in the 1980s. They're commonly spotted throughout southeast Wyoming, but there is little data concerning their exact numbers. Now a joint research project by the University of Wyoming and Wyoming Game and Fish is trying to change that. Up in the mountains, researchers Alex May and Jake Warner are on the trail of a cow moose. They collared the moose in the spring and have a general idea of where she is.
So we'll get out here and try to see if we can, if she's close by or if we need to drive somewhere else.
May is a master's student for the UW Co-op. He says it's important to see the moose.
A big part of it is how many calves does she have? Does she have one or does she have two? And these are all moose that we determined to be pregnant when we captured them in March. And then we're also looking at calf survival throughout the summer.
As he picks his way across a windy bluff, May explains that elsewhere, moose calves frequently die in the first couple of weeks after birth, but not in the Snowies.
But what we're seeing so far with this population is that many calves are surviving through the summer, but they have a hard time in winter. We seem to lose a lot of them between August and winter period.
We hike down a ridge and find a second bluff that overlooks a large valley with the Snowy Range Mountains in the background. There is a river with lots of trees and bushes, a great hiding place for a moose.
So I'll probably walk to the end of that point just to be sure. But right now it sounds like she's right in there. Yeah.
The researchers are trying hard not to startle the moose. They don't want her to take off without seeing her.
As soon as she has our scent and hears a twig snap, then the game's up and they usually walk off or trot off, and you really have no hope of catching up, you know.
We see a coyote, we see a deer, but no sign of our moose. And then, boom, there she is, staring at us. And then they are off.
The cow got startled and she came out of her hiding spot and crossed the river, and now she's running through the sage, and her calf is probably 50 or 60 yards behind her.
So you saw one?
One calf, yeah.
May says this particular cow and calf looked very healthy, but others looked thin and ribs were poking out.
And a lot of these moose that are on these river drainages actually winter high up in the forest. Like when we catch her, she's clear over on that ridge line in the trees, and then she comes all the way out this river in the summertime. So one of the goals of this project is to find out why, which strategies are more productive for survival and calf production versus others.
One theory is that beetle kill in the forest is helping moose survive. Corey Klass is in charge of the project for the Wyoming Game and Fish Department.
Especially with beetle kill, if more openness in the forest canopy creates better moose populations, et cetera, then maybe that's something we should look at down the road. But yeah, I mean, certainly trying to pick out the things that are benefiting the herd and try and get those in other herds as well.
Klass says if they can figure out what habitat is better for moose, they should be able to replicate that elsewhere in the state. But first, there are many more moose to find. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
A quick update since this story first aired is that moose in southeast Wyoming are doing much better than expected. We plan another story on this topic soon. When we come back, we'll hear about the challenges facing mule deer and get an update on the Wyoming toad. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to the Wildlife Edition of Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Bob Beck. Life isn't easy for the Wyoming Range mule deer herd. They face harsh winters and make long migrations over rugged mountains. And for the last 20 years, the herd has been in decline, and nobody really knew why. But 5 years ago, this month, a collaborative effort began to radio collar deer, giving scientists a chance to get a closer look at what's threatening the herd. To mark that milestone, we have two stories about the efforts of the Wyoming Mule Deer Project. We'll start by revisiting a story about fawn survival reported by Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards last summer.
If you want to catch mule deer fawns, you've got to get up pretty early in the morning. It's 5 a.m. when University of Wyoming research scientist Samantha Dwinell gets on her computer. She checks signals emitted from a radio-collared pregnant doe that show she's been hunkering down in one spot.
Oh man, that's beautiful.
There we go.
That's exactly what we're looking for.
The doe's been there all night, and that means she probably gave birth. Dwinell and her crew quick pack up their gear and jump into the truck to go find the doe, and hopefully her fawns. Deer almost always give birth to twins, and they want to put radio collars on both of them. Last year at this time, most of the fawns were already born. But things are different this time. Dwinell says ultrasounds show that fawns haven't grown as big as they should have.
We had, you know, the harsh winter. We saw sort of a depressed fetal development, and we weren't quite sure what that means. And so far, what it appears to be meaning is that everything is delayed.
So they're being born and they're healthy, but it's just later.
Yeah, exactly.
Last year's fawns, though, aren't around anymore. When their moms couldn't dig down through the snow that piled up to 175% of normal, many fawns died of malnutrition. Wyoming Game and Fish Department's Gary Fralick sits next to me in the backseat of the truck. He says this herd has been losing numbers for a while now, and it was another bad winter in the early 90s that started their slide. He says back then, Game and Fish tried to keep the herd size at around 38,000, but when it rose higher, the agency dished out more hunting licenses.
During those 2 years, a fairly liberal doe harvest was followed by an extremely severe winter in 1993. And those three factors, 2 years of substantial doe harvest followed by a severe winter, really lowered the population.
But even after the agency cut back on hunting, the population never rebounded. Now, there's only around 20,000. Fralick remembers some very angry hunters showing up at public meetings. Trucks wore bumper stickers that read, "Save a deer, kill a wildlife biologist." It got ugly. But Fralick says, back in 93, agencies didn't have the hard science to back their policies. Now they have 24 years worth to help them answer some questions.
What we need to understand is why these deer succumb so severely in some of these winters.
We follow the Grays River deep into the backcountry and start hiking. Dwinell carries an antenna and receiver that beeps faster as we get closer to the doe. We do our best to tiptoe over the snow and fallen trees. Then we see the doe mosey by.
They're very near. We're 40 meters from it right now. It's good when they walk away slow like that. It usually, they do that when they have a fawn. Just try to be stealth and quiet and sneak away.
Mom is trying to keep us from finding her fawns. We start looking anyway. But Dwinell says moseying isn't something this doe has done much of in the last couple of months.
She migrates from her winter range outside of LaBarge and Big Piney over the Wyoming range. All of the deer within this population, or almost all of them, make these incredible journeys over some pretty gnarly terrain.
Barbed wire fences, gas fields, subdivisions, this doe has seen it all. And after this winter, she's lucky to be alive, according to Kevin Monteith, the University of Wyoming wildlife biologist heading this study.
Of the adult females that were there at the beginning of winter, we've lost nearly 40% of them, which is pretty striking to lose that many adult females.
Normally, only about 15% die in winter. But Monteith says all this loss could be good news for survivors like this doe and her young.
We now have many fewer mouths on that landscape to feed. So that's not necessarily what we want, but in turn, what that means for each individual animal that remains is potentially more, better food available to each one of them.
Game and Fish's Gary Fralick agrees there's benefits for science. He says it's an opportunity to learn something about how mule deer pull through.
This population will in fact recover as they have done for hundreds if not thousands of years.
And because of the hard winter, the study has been funded for two more years. It takes us a while, but we eventually find the two fawns curled up under logs. Quickly, Dwinell and Fralick begin weighing and measuring them.
I'm wanting to try to get blood on this one, but it's kicking a bunch and I don't know if I'll be successful. You chill. Just gonna hang tight with her if you don't mind.
That's me she's talking to. I do my best to hold down a squirming, healthy fawn. The frustrated mom runs circles around us, huffing and stomping. The crew pulls radio collars over their tiny heads, takes photos, and then...
Yeah, I think we're ready to go.
Ready to release them?
They let them go, and the fawns wobble off into the forest to hide again, camouflaged, instantly. If they survive disease and predators, in a few months, they'll still have a long walk into winter ahead of them. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Looks like we're good.
Turns out winter for those little fawns wasn't so bad. The smaller herd size meant deer had more to eat last summer, so they got fat and healthy. But winter isn't the only thing that makes survival hard. Energy development also takes its toll. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson met back up with research scientist Sam Dwinell at Spring Captures to learn more.
The easiest way to describe how the Wyoming Mule Deer Project collects its data on deer is NASCAR pit crew. They're swift, but much more tender with the deer than you'd be with a race car. First, the deer are located using GPS coordinates transmitted from their radio collars. Then a helicopter crew captures and transports them to a field lab where a team of scientists and volunteers are ready to spring into action.
Cameron, is the scale working? Okay.
The deer arrive blindfolded to keep them calm, and their legs are bound so they can't kick anyone. University of Wyoming research scientist Sam Dwinell kneels on the ground and cradles the head of a deer in her hands.
She goes way up into the graze.
It's cool to watch her recognize this deer and recount her journey. Uh-huh. She's number 88. She summers up by the Graze River. Dwinell knows that from data collected from her collar.
Yellow one. Beautiful.
Dwinell confirms the transmitting information for a new collar she'll put on with fresh batteries and updated software. And while she does that, the team checks percent body fat and to see if she's pregnant. They'll insert a transmitter into her birth canal so they'll know when her fawn is born. And they'll weigh her, draw blood, collect a fecal sample, take her temperature, and measure her oxygen saturation and pulse. Since 2013, Dwinell has coordinated the collaring of over 370 deer. The goal is to keep collars on 70 adult does and as many fawns as possible. As deer die, she replenishes the sample size by capturing more deer. Dwinell says that 5 years of research shows that habitat is what drives the trajectory of mule deer populations in Wyoming, and the presence of oil and gas infrastructure on winter ranges doesn't help because that's where deer go to feed when the mountains are covered in snow.
And so when energy development occurs in those areas, you not only get the direct habitat loss from where roads are developed and where well pads are developed, but what my research has found is that you get an indirect habitat loss where animals are responding in their behavior and that they're avoiding those areas.
And that means the animals are stressed and eating less, and that impacts their ability to carry fawns to term and makes them more susceptible to disease. But she's sympathetic to the resistance some folks have to her findings.
You know, this research is happening in these communities that really depend on oil and gas development. It's how a lot of people survive in those communities.
And that's why she's hoping her research can help bring about smarter development, because she knows these communities love their mule deer.
They're very connected to the landscape through hunting and through recreation in those communities. And it's just two things that they value. And so there is always going to be a compromise, but there's ways of considering mule deer populations while still developing those areas.
Dwinelle did a close study of where and how mule deer consume sagebrush in proximity to well pads, pipelines, and roads. And she's researched ways for development to mitigate habitat loss. She did a series of public talks recently to help share that information.
It's always interesting, like the energy development aspects of my research are always what people have the most skepticism for.
Game and fish biologist Gary Freilich has been involved with the project from the start. He says this constant monitoring provides information that never existed before, and the public has been open to making changes.
For example, what type of hunting seasons do we design? Where do we target specific sections of highway to minimize vehicle collisions? How do we use the landscape or not use the landscape in some areas where we know that are crucial areas?
Several years ago, newborn fawns were dying at high numbers, and the project was able to test and confirm it was the adenovirus, a disease passed between deer when they end up in close quarters, like when people feed them. It's hard to get people to make changes to the way we handle energy development, but Freilich says it wasn't so hard with the adenovirus.
So we were able to convey that information to the public and working cooperatively with several communities to really pass regulations and rules that would prohibit people from providing supplemental feed.
Shauna Ridgway says she is seeing an openness to new ways of handling energy development in mule deer country. Her husband works in the oil fields, and Ridgway says when she talks to his coworkers, they share her concern for how the industry is affecting the deer. And apparently, Ridgway is always talking about the Wyoming Mule Deer Project.
So I kind of have been dubbed the crazy deer lady in Kemmer.
She's also the chair of the Kemmer Muley Fanatics chapter, one of the collaborating organizations that makes this research possible.
Used to be you could go out and take, you know, an afternoon drive and see hundreds of deer, and now, you know, you're lucky if you see a handful of them, so.
Ridgway says without conservation efforts, she's concerned her kids won't get the chance to hunt mule deer, let alone see them in the wild.
So I want to make sure that I'm doing my part, that they can do that.
Ridgway is hopeful they'll be able to keep the herd healthy as long as scientific research and a spirit of collaboration continues. Back at Captures, Dwinelle and her crew are releasing Deer 88. She prances off into the sagebrush. Deer 88 is pregnant, and Dwinelle hopes she gets to see her healthy newborn fawn this summer. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
The Endangered Species Act is facing increasing pressure to reform. Momentum in Congress and in Western states is building to make changes to the landmark regulation that protects threatened animals and plant species and their habitats. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim covered this story last summer.
On a warm, sunny day, a large group of people surround a truck wearing rubber boots and sunglasses. As the driver lifts up the trunk, cameras snap to capture the hopping, palm-sized amphibian in clear boxes.
All right, our toads are here!
These are Wyoming toads, one of the state's 12 endangered species. Doug Kineth is with the Fish and Wildlife Service. He's leading a group to reintroduce around 250 toads back into the wild.
We're going to release a few boxes right down over here.
Down at the lakeshore, Sharon Taylor kneels down next to her two daughters. She picks up a brown, warty toad in between her thumb and finger.
Let's put him. This is Caitlin's. Christina, step back, because we don't want to step on him.
Taylor did her PhD on the Wyoming toad's decline. She says this is the last spot wild Wyoming toads were seen in 1985. Then only 16 individuals were found.
There he goes.
Oh, that's adorable.
Now released in endangered species.
It was over 30 years ago that the Wyoming toad was first listed as endangered. The toad recovery to date has been a huge collaborative effort with landowners, nonprofits, the state, and the University of Wyoming. As to when the toad will be taken off the list, Fish and Wildlife Services Kynath said, recovery will take a long time.
That is a biological question, not a political question.
But it is often a political question. The Endangered Species Act, or ESA, is credited with keeping 99% of listed species from crossing over into extinction. Nevertheless, critics contend the act is outdated and ineffective, burdening local wildlife managers with excessive federal oversight and leading to long-running legal battles to get species off the list. Brian Nesvik is with Wyoming's Game and Fish Department. He's seen firsthand the failures of the act and how state management would be superior. One example, the grizzly bear.
The goal is not perpetual federal management.
And if there is ever a time for reform, it's now. Both Congress and state leaders are taking advantage of the current anti-regulatory fervor. Since January, 28 pieces of legislation were introduced taking aim at the bill. Several focused on making amendments to the act itself.
Why is now the right time? I think, number one, because it's overdue. I think, number two, due in large part to Governor Mead's leadership.
In June of 2015, Wyoming Governor Matt Mead launched an initiative as the chairman of the Western Governors Association to examine the ESA and make policy recommendations to Congress. Governor Mead's policy advisor, David Wilms, explains.
When we have a species that's recovered, how do we get to that recovered species to the point of delisting where it's back in state control?
Still, Wilms says he recognizes changing the act may be an uphill battle, but reforms might be easier to swallow from a state-led movement than from Congress. He says that reforms wouldn't weaken the act, but improve it. And Wyoming Senator John Barrasso is on board.
Well, today the Environment Public Works Committee continues its efforts to consider feedback from state officials on the need to modernize the Endangered Species Act.
That was a Senate committee hearing from last month. Barrasso says the act just isn't working in its current form.
For every 100 species added to the list, only 3 have recovered enough to come off of the list. Well, you know, as a doctor, I will tell you, for every 100 people I put in the hospital, only 3 recovered enough to get out. You know, I lose my medical license.
Like Nesvik, Barrasso says he believes getting species off the list and back into state management needs to be a priority. But when ESA reformers talk about modernizing, many ears perk up in conservation communities. Noah Greenwald is one of them. He's with the Center for Biological Diversity.
I think these calls are entirely disingenuous. Modernize, you know, when it comes from the likes of Matt Mead, is a euphemism for gut protections for endangered species.
Greenwald takes issue with their complaints about the act. He says it shouldn't be judged by how few species have been removed from the list, but by how many have been saved. Greenwald says the ESA is an insurance policy for when states fail to protect their species.
The states have primary jurisdiction over wildlife within their boundaries. The fact that species get listed reflects the fact that they weren't able to manage that.
He says states simply don't have the expertise or funding to properly protect their species, and that a potential return to state management would result in an uptick of extinctions. Back at Mortensen Lake, Taylor gets emotional when she remembers reintroducing toads there for the first time over 20 years ago, when they were on the brink of extinction.
And seeing all carcass after carcass when they were dying, and we were down to like approximately 50 animals, so it's just phenomenal to be out here today doing this.
2 decades of collaboration, and now a total of about 1,500 Wyoming toads. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Since President Trump took office last year, there have been 65 pieces of legislation targeting the Endangered Species Act, up from 28. And the Wyoming toad is doing great since it was released last summer, with wild breeding already taking place. When we come back, we'll wrap up the program. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Melody Edwards. The death of a grizzly bear in Grand Teton National Park on Thanksgiving Day of 2012 triggered calls for ending the park's annual elk hunt. A hunting party shot the grizzly after the hunters said that the bear charged them. The park superintendent at the time, Mary Gibson Scott, called the bear's death a travesty. It was the first hunting-related grizzly death in the park. But Scott said her agency, the National Park Service, can't just end the hunt. Rebecca Huntington reported this story in 2013. Park Superintendent Mary Gibson Scott says she understands the public outrage over the bear's death.
I saw the grizzly bear, the dead carcass, on the back of a truck on Thanksgiving morning. Don't think that I don't take that extremely, deeply personal.
But Scott says it's not that simple to end the park elk hunt. The law that expanded Grand Teton National Park in 1950 requires the National Park Service and Wyoming Game and Fish Commission to work together to jointly come up with recommendations for an elk reduction program, basically setting a hunting season for elk in the park.
It's in the legislation. Legislation can be amended, but that's not within my authority. My authority is to implement and administer the law. I don't create law.
Scott says one reason the hunt endures is because conditions, including elk migration patterns and a lack of natural winter range, haven't changed since 1950.
And one has to ask the question, why have conditions not changed? Why do we have such a high elk population, the largest in the country, that it requires a harvest every year in Grand Teton National Park? And the answer is because of supplemental feeding. The winter range for this herd comes in on flatbed trucks.
State and federal agencies have been feeding elk for more than a century because human development has taken up the valley floors. And that means less access to natural forage for the elk.
The system, from an ecological standpoint, is highly artificial.
Steve Kane is a senior wildlife biologist for the park. He's been working on how to manage the elk herd for many years. He says artificial feeding has implications not just for elk, but also for other wildlife. Artificial feeding prevents elk from starving in the winter and leaving carcasses for grizzlies to scavenge on when they emerge from hibernation in the spring. Instead, the bears now dine on gut piles left by hunters in the fall, which can sometimes lead to encounters, like the one that killed the grizzly on Thanksgiving morning.
Clearly, predators have increased since 1950. We now have healthy populations of grizzly bears and wolves back in the system, and they are doing their share at taking elk calves and regulating the population, but we still have literally thousands of elk that migrate through the park, and that's the one opportunity that the agencies have to harvest and manage the elk herd.
Environmental groups have sued to stop artificial feeding, but that could mean fewer elk for hunters, wildlife watchers, and even predators, such as grizzlies. If feeding stopped, elk may look for their next meal on cattle feed lines, where they could increase the risk of spreading the disease brucellosis. All that makes ending feeding a politically and economically dicey decision. Even so, Scott says, park officials are looking for options to tweak the park hunt.
Whether that's changing areas, hunter density, number of bullets, whatever you can think of, we are internally analyzing and discussing that to mitigate to the degree we can.
But Scott says she can't end the hunt unilaterally. And park biologist Steve Kane adds that ending the hunt would essentially create a giant safe zone for elk. It wouldn't take the elk long to figure out how to outsmart hunters by essentially staying in the safe zone. And that would impact hunting outside the park. Although the hunt is likely to continue, Scott agrees with critics that it is an awkward fit for a national park.
An elk reduction program or a hunt is not consistent with traditional values of national parks. Hunting in national parks is extremely unique. So it does have inconsistencies with the values of wildlife viewing and visitor experience. We know that. But the law is the law.
If people want to see that change, Scott says they'll have to take it up with the body that writes the law, and that's Congress. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Huntington in Jackson.
And on a lighter note, the call of nature echoes rather lamely from a stuffed animal. And that can only mean one thing. It's the annual Wyoming Taxidermy Competition. A few years back, Tristan Autone went to Casper and took it all in.
I'm standing next to a spotted skunk doing a handstand on a rock when Dwayne Miller asks me this question.
You ever look at a chicken up close?
I haven't.
All birds have an S shape in their neck, yeah. And mine is not quite right. I missed it by a little bit.
Miller is a taxidermist from New Mexico. He stands about 5'6", has a big bushy white beard, and his mustache is coffee-colored after years of cigarettes. His specialty is birds, and the chicken he's submitted to competition is good, but just a little off and could use a bit of work. We discuss how the spine of a chicken works, but only briefly before he's distracted.
That's a nice mallard right there.
Miller moves on to the mallard. I move on toward another piece, a crocodile, leaping through the air, out of a river, with its choppers firmly clamped on the foot of a shrieking baboon. It's my favorite. The show and competition feature taxidermists, seminars, and industry salesmen, and it's put on by the Wyoming Association of Taxidermy Artists. Lynn Stewart is president of the association, and he says the competition is important to professionals and hobbyists alike, but it's also good for business.
If you come to this show and you win a best of show and a ribbon, you can take the pictures and advertise and show your specialty and perhaps draw more clients in.
Stewart says each year the work gets better, and he leads me past a grizzly bear chasing after a mountain sheep perched on a tall rock, as well as a pine marten provocatively sprawled out on a moose antler over a bed of snow, to the showroom, so I can see all the tools and chemicals the industry uses.
These are deer eyes, mule deer eyes, and they can all suffice for medium antelope eyes, and we can buy these just like this. They cost $7.25 a pair.
There are also rubber noses, foam forms to mount the animals on, and a range of books the artists use for reference on mouth shapes, hair tufts, and flesh colors. Stewart says most taxidermists who come to the show don't just come to compete, but to improve their level of taxidermy.
What they're trying to do is recreate the anatomy to the best of their ability so it looks natural and real for either a client or a museum or a display wherever the specimen goes.
This learning process is typically facilitated by judges. Manny Chavez is a 24-year taxidermy veteran and a veteran judge.
We judge on craftsmanship, and then we judge on anatomical accuracy of everything that's in here.
Chavez puts his nose to the nose of a mule deer to check the symmetry of the eyes. Then he checks the tear ducts, then the ears, then the mouth, making marks to a score sheet for each part of the animal.
You just go down the line and you grade as you go. If it's not correct, then you deduct.
This particular mule deer is in the professional division. The other two divisions are novice and master. Each state has their own criteria for people to be judged in these divisions, but generally,
if a person gets two blue ribbons, say 2 years in a row, or two blue ribbons at this show, then next year he's automatically bumped up to the higher class until he becomes a master.
And that's not easy. It takes practice and critique. When Chavez and the other judges are finished, they'll meet one-on-one with the artists, if the artists want them to, and tell them where they can improve. One of those artists is Susan Orchid from Pinedale. She brought a peacock, but she's a little disappointed with her score.
I was looking to proceed into masters on my birds, but the competition this year, as far as the judges that they had this year, were tough.
Where did you get the peacock?
I bought him out of Ohio.
What, like alive or?
Well, he was alive when I bought him. And then they killed him and sent him down to me.
Orchid explains that she had a few problems getting the peacock mounted. For one, it was hard to clean all the meat out of the wingtips, and she nearly dropped the bird from competition because her efforts weren't going well.
So I called my local mortician and said, hey, you got anything for smelly birds? And by gosh, he did.
Well, what did he have?
It was an injection to mask the smell of decomp. But yeah, it worked.
Taxidermist Joe Hargrave from Du Bois says there's a key to this type of competition.
Taxidermist that competes is always thinking ahead, and the wheels are already turning for next year, like better pieces to bring and something to get that award to hang on their shelf at home in their shop.
This year, Hargrave brought a mountain lion lazily lying on a tree branch. It took second place, as well as Mayor's Choice Award. He's eyeing the lion proudly, sipping a Crown and Coke, and says that he knows exactly what he's going to do next year to show up his competition, but he refuses to say what that is.
Well, if I told you, I'd get out, and then someone would steal my idea.
Fair enough. I'll let you off the hook.
Classified. You have to come to the next show to find out.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tristan Autone.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. We'll be back with a brand new show next week. And don't forget to support Wyoming Public Radio News with your pledge of support. You can do it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just hit the pledge button.
And while you're there, you can listen to our stories from today and in the past. You can also sign up for a podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.